Welcome to a Prevent Connect audio conference recording. The following was recorded on May 22nd at a Call to Men's 2009 Annual National Conference in New York City, New York. To learn more about A Call to Men, visit their website at www.acalltomen.org.
I've been doing this work for a long time, and I have to say that this morning has left me feeling not just inspired, but just in awe of the amazing women who walk across this stage and who walk through my life. So, Vanessa, thank you. To continue in that vein, I have the privilege of inviting up, and as I speak, if the panelists would make their way up front, I'd really appreciate that. Inviting up a panel of incredible and amazing women from around this country who have committed their lives to this work, but who have also committed to join with A Call to Men in their efforts to speak our truths as women. So I'd like to invite up, and let me just say that in the program, by omission, Pat Ng's name was left off the agenda, but I'd like to invite up Desiree Allen Cruz, Bea Hansen, Nona Fasu, Katie Gentile, Tanya Lovelace, and Pat Ng, my sisters in this work. The panelist is going to spend the next period of time talking as national leaders, having yet another conversation about the challenges and concerns that come to bear as men come into this work as allies. Desiree, are you moderating? So I'm going to step out of the way so that Desiree can do her thing. Thank you.
Good morning. It is awesome to be here. It is almost humbling, actually it's very humbling, to follow the crew that came on this morning. Very powerful woman warriors. And I'm glad to be counted amongst them. Before we begin our panel, I would like to take a moment to acknowledge and appreciate the ancestors, the original people of this land from this area. I want to thank the ancestors for allowing us, my people, to be on this land, to share the land with us, and for the ancestors from this area to allow me to be a part of what's going on in this area. I do want to thank the other women warriors of this panel in looking at and getting now to meet a few of these women warriors. I am truly honored to be here. I am Desiree Allen Cruz. I am Nez Perce on my father's side, Umatilla, Walla Walla, and Cayuse on my mother's side. Both sides are warriors and medicine people. In preparing for this panel, in trying to understand what other women warriors around the country believe need to happen, we have a series of questions that we will attempt to get through in the time given. First question. In working with well-meaning men, what lessons have you learned about their commitments to this work? I'll open up to any one of the panelists to start. In working with well-meaning men.
Maybe I'll start with a story. Can people hear me? So yesterday, after I left here, I had to go back to my office after Tony and Paul spoke in the morning, and I got off the subway, and as I was walking toward my office, I was wondering where the well-meaning men were, and I'll tell you why. So I'm walking toward my office, and I see this guy who is screaming at the top of his lungs, and he is taking what I later found to be a cell phone and throwing it really hard down on the ground. Here's the cell phone. This is just the top part of it, and there's little bits of it. And behind him was a woman, and I couldn't tell what was happening with that woman when I first got closer, but found that she was just sobbing uncontrollably and screaming at this guy and sobbing about what he's done. There are about three men that were kind of next to him, kind of all watching this but giving him a really wide berth. And as I was coming closer, I saw there was a cop coming down at the other end of the block, walking really kind of toughly, but very, very, very slowly. So I saw this happen, and as I got closer and closer, I was deciding what should I do? And none of the men did a thing. They just stood there and watched and gave him a wide berth. Before I got there, he rounded the corner, his girlfriend or whoever she was, rounded the corner after him, coming after him. And it really made me think about what was with these guys and where were the well-meaning men and what were they doing. I stopped and talked to one guy who said, yeah, I was just opening up my restaurant and I saw this happen. And I said, well, it's interesting because I just came back from this conference called A Call to Men, and it's all about what men's role is in responding to domestic violence. And I gave him information and I showed him the information from the conference. And he was a nice guy, but he did nothing. And the cop kind of, when I got there, the cop got there, and I said to him, what is going on? There's something going on here. This guy just smashed the hell out of this woman's cell phone, and he said, yeah, I'm going there now. And he wasn't going to get there because they were a block away. And, I'm thinking from his perspective, well, I don't know if this is a crime. There's damage of property, but, from his perspective, I don't know if that's really a crime. So I'm just wondering where the hell the well-meaning men are, So I just want to open it up to the panel. And so I spent all my time thinking about what I should have done, and I'm really trying to refocus on, what should those guys have done, and what do we need men to do in situations where violence is happening right in front of our eyes and nothing is going on. And I didn't feel safe to say anything either because, there's guys around and they're not saying anything. So that's my experience with well-meaning men over the last 24 hours. So I open it up to my friends and colleagues.
Go ahead.
Thanks for that story, Bea. Can you
Thanks,
hear me?
Pat.
Is this on?
Yeah, it's on.
Actually, this is the question that I struggled with a lot on the way here this morning. And actually, I've been struggling with it over the past 2 years. So I want to share a story with you. I hope that it's going to be coherent because there are many thoughts jumbled into it, many emotions jumbled into it. Yet I feel like it's really important, for me to sort out. So I'm sorry. It's going to take a little bit of time to do this. And that is, when I saw this question, what's the question again? It's really early in the morning for me too. In working with well-meaning men, what lessons have you learned? I think what I've learned is that there's a difference between well-meaning and those who get it. So here's a story that I want to tell you, and in it is, I guess, mistakes that I've made and lessons that I've learned, and I think still learning. So I look at B, because B was my former boss. For 2 years. No, it has nothing to do with, sorry. First, let me back up a little bit and introduce myself to you all. So I'm Pat Ng. Right now, I'm the Vice President of Programs at the Ms. Foundation for Women. I've worked for a very, very long time working on issues of domestic and sexual violence, mostly within, you know, the Asian community, although my work, you know, at the Ms. Foundation takes me sort of more on a bird's eye national level. But I'm going to talk about a story and a situation that happened 2 years ago that I struggled with. And I guess I'm going to be talking about an organization that I'm not going to name because I have not yet discussed this, you know, right before this day with the organization. And this organization is an organization that I love and dearly respect on many different levels. I was struggling with a situation where a man was offered the position of the executive director of a domestic violence organization founded by and for women. The goal, you know, was of this organization was, you know, the very big goal is to end violence against women by doing a couple of things. You know, one is to address immediate needs. The second is to advance women's leadership. And the third is organizing communities. And I guess I struggled with this, you know, because for many years, for the past 10 years, at the Ms. Foundation, I have worked very hard to invite women into this movement. worked very hard, actually, for the past 25 years to invite women into this movement, and really hard over the past 10 years to invite men into this movement. And I'm so very honored to be here in this space and to see the incredible work that's happening, both within this organization, A Call to Men, as well as many other men's organizations, I think, that are doing some amazing work. But I worked hard, you know, over the past 10 years to invite men into this movement. And I think, you know, building on the Ms. Foundation's very strong history of funding the first domestic violence coalition in the country, and also, you know, the first batterers intervention program in the country, you know, I think the precursor to today's work. And I guess, you know, I kept struggling with, I would sanction this move to hire an executive director as this man, as executive director of this domestic violence organization, as long as I was sure that he gets it, that he was a well-meaning man. So I guess I'm struggling with you, and I'm really trying to, really honestly, I think, work this out here, and I'm very sorry that I didn't get a chance to do this beforehand, and I'm very sorry for taking up a lot of time, but it really is something that I think I've really been struggling with. And so today, the question is, and it's framed over time in different questions, so today the question is whether or not this is actually a personal, you know, issue or a political issue, whether this is about me or about something bigger. So I wanted to give you a little bit of, Vanessa was talking about, you know, knowing the backstory. So I do feel like I have to give you a little bit of backstory. I am the youngest daughter of Chinese immigrant parents who have five girls. And no sons. I was their last hope for a son. I went to an all-girls high school, founded a women's organization, I work for the first women's foundation in the country. I have dedicated my heart and soul at the intersections of race, class, and gender. Not because I wanted to, but because I had to. So I guess I'm telling you this because this work is so important to me. And I really struggled, you know, with inviting men in because I think that this is, you know, so critical to this movement. And so when I struggled with this question, I had to ask Ted. Ted, are you here? He's around somewhere. And Ted, I think, illuminated for me what I was struggling with in one very succinct sentence. He said, well, if he gets it, he would not have applied for the position. So, I guess I'm not telling you that there are many other things in here that I think I'm skipping, you know, around on. And I'm telling you this, you know, because I realize that while it is so important and critical, and I'm so wholeheartedly with this work, I think that there are still questions, you know, of what roles are. Yes. So I guess I'll leave it at that. But one more thing, you know, about this. And I guess I'm questioning whether or not an organization has a soul, whether or not, you know, is advancing leadership of women, you know, implicit in the work to end violence in the lives of women. Is it critical, you know, for organizations working on violence against women to advance women's leadership? These are just some of the questions that I've been struggling with this morning and over the past couple of weeks. And I'm so sorry if I'm actually not being so coherent overall. And there are a lot of things, I think, buried, you know, in here. But I just wanted to put it out here because I think as more and more men you know, enter this work, which I think is great. I just, you know, want to ask more about roles. So I hope that that makes sense.
Good morning, everyone. I don't think this
yours
is
actually might not be on.
We'll just do this.
Can we pick it off?
Okay. We'll try.
Good morning, everyone. I am Tanya Lovelace, and I am with the Women of Color Network. And I'm really pleased to be here, and I'm really honored to be here with a call to men who've really become my brothers over the past few years and the work that they're doing, and they've really supported the work that Women of Color Network is doing and think it's a great partnership. So I feel really blessed about the relationship that we're developing as two organizations. You know, the question about what have I learned about well-meaning men? I think that for me, you know, it's funny because as a woman of color, you know, I look at this, I think, in layers. It's you know, almost as if, you know, I have to look at everybody from various different perspectives. So there's a particular relationship that I have to men of color. There's a particular relationship that I have to white men. There's a particular relationship that I have to white women. There's a particular relationship that I have to women of color. So in asking me what have I learned about men, about well-meaning men, it's interesting because my layers, I think, come into play. And so when I'm thinking about men of color and what I've learned about men of color in this work, I've learned that that on some levels they are natural allies in this work. In some ways, that they are natural allies in terms of survival for our communities. So there's a true sense of interest in survival for our communities, and I think that therefore, there is that brother-sister, I think, relationship that men of color and women of color have. And for me, I would almost say it's an inherent relationship that we have. I would say that for white men, there probably are some additional layers of a relationship that may have to be developed and, I think, overcome in order to have, I think, true interactions. And so I think I'm I think I'm learning to try to move past those layers and have those conversations and those interactions. And I can say I haven't had that many of those with white men. You know, so I'm interested in having those conversations. I think that when it comes to the concept of well-meaning, I have to be very clear that, you know, and I also recognize that I speak for a group of women of color when I'm thinking about the membership of Women of Color Network and the advisors and staff and so forth. And so in thinking about well-meaning men and the relationships that we've had so far, it's been an interesting and a mixed space, because I think that, you know, men have to, the concept of well-meaning is, first we have to look at it as a term that people, I think, would then take on for themselves. So I'm a well-meaning man, or somebody would put the term on someone, he's a well-meaning man. So I think sometimes men are there with that language, but the actions haven't necessarily caught up. So there may be that they're there with earnest and with interest, but I'm not sure always that the label has met up with the behavior. So there have been times in which I've been in spaces with men who may call themselves well-meaning, who may be labeled as well-meaning, but have not necessarily gotten there. And I don't see that as unlike relationships with white women who may see themselves or perceive themselves as allies and have not yet gotten there, but really want to be there. And so we've done some work. A call to action is some work that we've been doing around the country, in which we've been doing teleconferences with women of color only, which is one line of conversations that we've had, and then conversations with women of color and allies. And allies really are, you know, we're looking to men, and we're looking to white people. And so sometimes we have white men, white women, men of color who are on these calls. Those calls have been great. We came up with two statements, one for women of color, one for women of color and allies. And those statements were mentioned yesterday by Valerie, so I was really glad that she put that out there. And you know, I'll mention something about that a little bit later, but to just say that, you know, so we really hope that you'll contact us so that you can get the statement. Unfortunately, we can't put the statements on the website because we're really trying to stem any kind of co-optation from fatherhood groups or from men's rights groups who may not understand that that's a dialogue within the movement that we're trying to have and may really think that they can take that and use that against our movement. So when you go online and you go to our website, you'll see that we have an executive summary of the statements, but we don't necessarily have the language there. You have to contact us and we'll get you the statements, but we won't have it on there because we don't want it to be used. We don't want it to be used negatively. We want to control that as much as we can. But there was a piece in that that really came out of the dialogues about aspiring. We have come up with the language of aspiring allies, which means that it's a work in progress. You never really arrive there. There's never really a place in which I think allies can really ever feel they've gotten to some end. I think to call themselves an ally, I think really means that you've gotten there. And I think that what we are really trying to say is you're always hopefully aspiring and that it's a daily process. And in fact, there was one woman of color who told a white ally that you turn in your ally card every night at midnight. It's an everyday thing. You have to start from scratch the next day. You don't get to wake up and feel as if you've achieved some destination because it's a constant process. So when I'm thinking about well-meaning, I'd like to think of that also as a process, that it's not a place where you ever really become. It's not a destination, it's a continuous journey. And I'd like to think that well-meaning men will continuously check in with women to make sure that on that journey that they are headed in the right direction. So that's where I'll leave it right now.
And this was one.
this question was definitely a difficult one also in just pondering what we considered well-meaning men. And in my work with tribal nations, it has always been that we include men, women, young and old, in trying to find solutions. So having that discussion with tribal nations has been real easy. But my work at the national level or with state coalitions, it's like we are so busy trying to ensure that the direct needs are taken care of, that the social change work with the various departments, the police, the courts, mental health, alcohol and drug, are addressed on a regular basis, that to stop, and it felt like I had to just stop and really ponder, what does that mean? What is a true definition of a well-meaning man? It's easy to do the work, but to take a step back and see what that really means in all the work that we do. So I understand the difficulty in trying to come up with an answer for that question. The next question, I'm sure, will raise some other concerns. What is required for men to stay at the table in an appropriate yet efficient way or effective way? What do you think? What is required for men to stay at the table in an appropriate yet effective way?
You know, I don't know how much more I can add to what Tanya just said, because I think that the entire time I was reading these questions in preparing for this, all I kept thinking, it's a constant process. And you have to remember, it's a constant process and you never really get there. So I think that's what you said. And I think that's, you know, that's the same for me. And I think that we also have to look at the fact that all of us have these, all of us have been socialized into a white supremacist patriarchy. So all these things are constantly occurring in all of us. I mean, I have to fight sometimes, and this is very embarrassing to admit, but, you know, I was raised to take care of men. I was raised to take care of my older brother who was learning disabled, you know. I had to not say I got an A because it would hurt his feelings. So, I mean, to protect the male ego, all male egos, is like a really big thing. So part of it, I'm doing one and two together.
That's fine.
So part of it is that it's a constant process for all of us. And that's part of what makes it easy to give up. Because it's a lot of work. It's a lot of work to think, oh, right, I'm with a well-meaning man or an aspiring, I love that term, an aspiring ally. But it still means I have to do a lot of work. And to communicate, because part of their socialization, I'll use, you know, a universal man, which is, I know, not good, but is to not take care of, not to be relational, not to really think about the impact on another. And so we can sometimes automatically go to this socialized place pretty easily, especially when we're anxious. So so I think just my having to pull back, lesson I learned, pulling back myself to quit doing so much work. But you have to know that they're going to do the work. And that's what's tough in terms, and know that they're going to be always aspiring while I'm always aspiring too. Because, you know, as you mentioned, we're all in the intersection of race, class, ethnicity, religion, sexuality, gender. I mean, it's a lot of work. So maybe I'm depressed too.
I think, you know, I didn't do justice to the last question since I was overcome with my particular issue of the day. But, you know, I think that there's, you know, I feel like I've had the privilege of working with an incredible number of well-meaning men, you know, and the men that I've encountered by and large in the domestic violence movement, while there have been few of them, I think have had an incredible ability to really focus on the issue, and I think some of it's what you were talking about earlier, Pat, about, you know, what's the struggle around leadership, you know, and the role of male leadership in a field like domestic violence. And I feel a little, you know, on the one hand, it's great to have male leadership, and if it's good male leadership, it's great to have that. On the other hand, it can be a slippery slope around leadership, because I think we also live in a society where men are the leaders, and you look at leadership of, you know, the whole issue of social service organizations, you know, I'm a social worker, and I'm on the board of the National Association of Social Work in New York City, and you know, one of the things is you look at social services and the you know, it's like 85% of workers are women, yet the leadership is predominantly male in social services. And you know, I don't know how you deal with that. At NASW, we have this quota system where the leadership, the folks who are on the board and the folks who are in leadership, need to be representative of both the body of social workers in terms of diversity, but also in terms of diversity of clients. So it restricts the number of men who can be on the board to only a few. You know, there's like a board of 30, and there's like two or three men. And every year we ask this question of like, well, should we have a very kind of strict limit on that, and there's an ability to open it up, and there's more men who want to be part of the board, and should we open it up? And I'm always resistant to doing that, because you open it up, and then I think the way we function as a society, men often rise as leaders, and we have an executive director who's a man. So I think it's a real struggle, because we're dealing with it in terms of the movement, but then also overall in society. And then when we have male men in leadership positions, you know, we're dealing with government, we're dealing with other folks, and we know that when men speak out about violence against women, that it's taken more seriously. How do we grapple with that? And how do we grapple with, you know, the billions of, or maybe not billions, but the lots of dollars that's focused into research on batterers and batterer behavior and offender behavior, and the dearth of research on what do women really need to help them who are victims of domestic violence is really missing. And we're really struggling with what exactly do women need to be able to survive and thrive. And where are the resources to do that? Because the only options I'm being general here, but the two main options we have for women who are victims of domestic violence are shelter and the criminal justice system. And most women don't want either of those. And we don't have, and there's not a lot of money pumped into those other resources. So, you know, and there's tons of money into research on batterers. So,
I don't know. Well, I just want to add to that. You know, I don't know if it's so much adding to what you've just said, because I think that you said that very clearly. But another, I guess, take on it as well is, right, I just think we have to stop doing things the way we've been doing them all along, right? So we have to start looking at other topics and other things to research. So that I agree with. One other thing I wanted to add, though, is in developing that statement, the ally statement, in which we had something like 386 advocates who continued to call in on these phone calls, who really wanted to have a voice. And to be very clear, we had over 600 advocates together in terms of women of color and women of color and allies who worked together on both of the statements. But in terms of the ally statement, one of the things that came up was about those who are aspiring to be allies and how that in and of itself can really become consuming, that then the attention becomes on being an ally. And being an ally becomes the center of the discussion and the center of the way in which you see yourself. And so it becomes about you again. And so that's a problem. It's a problem for it to become about you again. So how men can stay at the table, to me, is to remember that it's about violence against women. It's not really to create more spaces for men to have more conversation, this time to reverse some of the things they put into place. I think that it should be about having conversations to talk about how to address truly violence against women, their role in it, and I do think that a lot more of those spaces, such as what we have here, really definitely needs to be about men and women coming together, or at least men's work being done in the presence of women. And I think that that's one thing that I really appreciate about how A Call to Men does it, is because they do like to have women present, and they ask us to allow men to do the work they need to do, but I think they have us there for accountability. I think that when we look at, and as a woman of color, I also have to like bring in race, because it's just how I roll, right? I can't like not, I think it's how we roll as women of color. We just have to. But if I'm looking at that as well, that also means then that when we have ally sessions and they are about white allies as well, that people of color have to be a part of, in some way, not so much there to teach and educate, but to be there for accountability in some way. So I think that that was the unique piece about the call to action calls that we were having, was that it was with women of color and allies together on the call, and allies really stepping up and saying what they needed to do to be of support, or what they need to do for themselves to get better at on a daily basis at being an ally. But in the presence of women of color. So I think that men who are at the table have to be willing to do this work with women present. They have to be willing to ask women for guidance and support and acknowledge the leadership that women of color and that women across the board bring to the table. To acknowledge that this work was being done well before they came, and so that there's shoulders that they're already standing on when they get here. So it's about recognizing that breadth of experience that's already been laid, and it's about really challenging each other to have true support of women. But there's one other thing I just want to add. It's also, I think, about men sharing the secrets. Because I think that men have been able to get where they go because, by virtue of patriarchy, the system is built around what they know and how they know it. So there's secrets around that. I kind of want to come to a session where I learn, okay, so how do you really market things? How do you really develop a corporation? How do you really do these things? Because I think that these are the kinds of secrets that have to be unlocked and shared with women. Because I think the reason why 20, you know, like your average advocate makes about 24,000 is because, you know, the money's not there. I think they would be getting paid more if the money were there. So I think it's about men sharing what they know about how to accrue funds and how to pull that together in a capitalist society and operate that way. So.
Go ahead.
Okay, great. So, first of all, let me apologize. I mean, I feel like I've been having the previous conversation with myself so long that I'm not quite sure how that came across to you all. So, but around this question of, what is required for men to stay at the table, and you were talking about resources, as a funder who has funded this work, and really... for men, to do this work, and this money that we had to fund this work for men to do this work, came from women, and they came from survivors. We convinced, our donors that in order for us really to end violence against women, men were a critical part of that. And so that was something that we've been working on for the past 10 years, and I think to great success. But I think that what we talked about here, resources, I think that men actually, I'm hoping that at some point men actually come to the table, with money. That actually men, there's men's money, and there's a lot of it.
So.
And it is one. When you consider everything that you heard this morning, everything you heard yesterday, and what our women are saying here, that the products that we've become from the generations before us, the legacy that have been left for us, good or bad, when we're trying to figure out, even in with the work with the Women Color Network, that balance that needs to be in place for each of us, currently we're talking about a balance within a system, a balance of a construct that currently exists. But breaking it down, every woman, every man, every race and ethnicity, figuring out that balance individually, and with that balance, mentally, emotionally, physically, and spiritually, in doing this work, in understanding what it means to be an ally to each other. We don't have much time, so I want to get to the next question. But keeping in mind that that balance within the system has to be broken down to the balance of the individual at the table and each other, each of us holding each other accountable. So due to time, we will move to the last question. What is your vision of men's involvement in ending violence against women? What is your vision of men's involvement in ending violence against women? We have about 10 minutes.
Okay. Well, a couple of things. So something that I didn't say before, you know, is what I would love to see are many different things. I would want, you know, for well-meaning men to engage fully, not on a part-time basis, not because it's there and that you're invited, not at your convenience, but to come, I think, you know, with your heart, with an open heart, and a burning desire for change, is, I think, you know, what I was really wanting, I think, you know, to find in that sort of first story that I told you. I think, you know, what I'd love to see is for men to own this issue, not to help women or to be our saviors, but to become human in the process, I think, you know, someone was talking about earlier. I think that the women's movement has done an awful lot to change women's lives, but has also done a whole lot to change men's lives, almost as much as it did, I think, you know, for women. I think, you know, again, you know, men have been doing this work around anti-violence actually, you know, for a really long time. 1977 was when Emerge first came on the scene, the first, you know, abuser education program. Again, you know, it is, for me, it's not about saving, you know, saving women from other men, but, you know, about making yourself whole and creating cultural shifts that offer greater depth in humanity. And I think, you know, when we're talking about this man box and getting out of the man box, I think, you know, there's a lot of hard work to self-conscious, you know, consciousness raising. but I think also there needs to be, beyond consciousness raising, it's the take action piece. It's more than just stand up, you know, with the words. It is also about the action. That's what I like to say.
I'll be quick for time since I'm the time fascist here. I have it broken down into three things. I guess my vision would be I would never hear the term women's issue ever again. Ever, 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 ever again. Because, as Eve Ensler pointed out, it's not a women's issue. You know, I run the Women's Center, and this goes to number two, structural. I run the Women's Center. Women's Centers at CUNY, there's 19 CUNY schools, I think, and I think there's 9 women's centers. None of them have dedicated staff, as in I'm a professor, I teach, I do other things too. Jess is my dedicated staff. But other than that, and I'm lucky, woo, you know, 14,000 students, and we have one dedicated social worker. All right, because that certainly does enough. But let me get back on point. So structural. Women, what UNIFEM's statistics are that women do 80% of the world's work and receive 10% of the world's pay. Women's centers are not funded at all by CUNY, and there is a male initiative that's funded to the millions of dollars. I am not complaining that there is a male initiative. We need a male initiative. However, structural things would change so that women's work wouldn't have to be free. Or some of men's work became free. I don't care, but there has to be a balance somewhere along the line. We have to be recognized for everything we've done for free. And then personal, what I said earlier, we all have to work and reflect and realize, yes, we get to be more human and have that be valued instead of having patriarchal privilege and racial privilege be valued.
I guess my vision really is that they just stop, you know, that men just stop committing violence against women, and that would be a great vision. And I think the other one is to really be able to count on, so that when, you know, next time I have to confront a situation, that I can 100% count on, rely on the men that are around me to stand up, speak out, and confront violence against women, and that's not the case now.
I have a few points. One of them then would be that men would continuously challenge themselves around sexism. I mean, it's not just about whether or not there's violence against women, whether or not you support or don't support violence against women. It's about everyday interactions between men and women, how they operate. And so sexism as a construct, as an operational aspect, really needs to be addressed and looked at. Because well-meaning men can still support sexism on a daily basis, so that really needs to be addressed. Take us as we are, as women who are doing this work. You know, we sometimes, when you come to us, we may be in a angry mood. We may not like what you just said a little while ago. We may call you out on the stage. We may give you a phone call. You may get an angry email. Those kind of things do happen. Take us as we are, and be able to absorb that, use it, and then continue to move forward. I think that you know, sometimes in talking with women, there's a fear that there's a way in which we feel like we need to tiptoe around men, maybe not say directly how we feel because we're afraid we'll lose them. We're afraid that men, well, if you say that, then men won't stay in the movement. And I just think we really need to, as women, come at men and work with men with an open heart, recognize that men can make mistakes, but men in coming at the table with that, knowing that we're coming there with an open heart, you also have to be able to take what we bring back to you, because there are times in which we really need to call you on things. And it may just be that we've been working with men all day and hearing bad things about men, and you just walked in my office. So it could just be that that happened. I'm not trying to support any kind of negativity. I'm saying it can just be like that day. I just, you know, one more man in my office, you happen to be the one. That's just how it is. But really understanding that there is a process in really developing authentic relationships and interactions. And then finally, I think that I'd like to come back to what Pat was saying about funding. And I think that men can support women's advocacy, or can support advocacy against violence against women, can do that, and making sure and supporting that this work is fully funded. So it can be that it's fully funded in the trenches in terms of supporting it on a local basis, in terms of supporting it around fundraising, putting, you know, pulling money out of your own pocket, or engaging men to raise money so that you can fund local programs, but also in terms of public policy and connecting with national groups that are doing policy work in DC, that are doing policy work at the state level, and supporting that, again, that the actual legislation that's being pushed to try to make sure that there is funding built in, that that funding not only gets authorized, but that it also gets appropriated so that the money comes actually from DC into the coffers so that people can actually do the work.
To quote my favorite movie, Spider-Man, with great power comes great responsibility. With great power, men and women, young and old, comes great responsibility. The innate essence or beauty of the choices that you make in every instance, with every breath, is important. In this movement, in your work to be well-meaning men and other women who are aspiring allies, I ask you, as one First Nations person, do not forget the First Nations in your community. As a sweat. And for those of you who were at the New Orleans conference, I've seen you, I've recognized you, aspiring men allies, I do see that beauty in you. I'm glad you've taken steps to walk with me, to walk with us. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you for joining Prevent Connect Audio. Prevent Connect Audio is a project of the California Coalition Against Sexual Assault, with funding from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The views presented on Prevent Connect Audio are not necessarily the views of the United States government, the CDC, or CalCASA. You can contact us at info@preventconnect.org, or you can learn much more on our website at www.preventconnect.org.